On the open seas for days and sometimes weeks at a time. With shoddy living conditions, little time to rest, spoiled food to eat, and sometimes mistreatment by the ship's crew or captain. That's often the sort of the millions of men and women who make a living from fishing. More fishers die on the job than workers in almost any other profession. And sometimes, instead of receiving a just wage, they're given a share of the value of the fish they help to catch. And that can mean nothing. In a 2011 message for World Fisheries Day, celebrated on November 21st, the Vatican Office responsible for the Church's Apostleship for the Sea, the Pontifical Council for Migrants, expressed its concern on behalf of fishermen.
For all of them, every day is a struggle against the forces of nature that devastate their boats and nets, some of which in a very dramatic way, like the tsunami in Asia in 2004, and more recently in Japan. They have to face climate change and ecological or environmental disasters that, together with overfishing, destroy the source of their livelihood and, finally, the economic system that exploits their hard work. These facts are making fishing one of the most dangerous and hazardous occupations in the world.
Until recently, no international legislation has protected the working conditions of the world's fishermen. Under the UN umbrella, 437 countries in June 2007 overwhelmingly agreed to a new convention for fishermen. The ILO's Decent Working Conditions, Safety and Social Protection Working in Fishing Convention. But only a rare few have ratified it.
We would like to unite our voice to the voices of fishers, to invite the international organizations and governments to develop standards which will ensure decent and productive work for fishers' employment, income, and food security, and to have the Work in Fishing Convention 2007 ratified to guarantee a safe working environment and welfare provisions.
Ted Richardson is just one of the many in the church calling for ratification of the convention. He's the former regional director of the Apostleship of the Sea in Oceania and has dedicated much of his life to assisting maritime workers. I asked him why the reluctance of many nations to sign the dotted line.
And everyone says, well, we've got better standards than this in that country anyway, so why bother ratifying it? The point of ratifying is that it makes it law that people can't abuse somebody else's labour. That if a ship came to my country and we've ratified this, we have the power to say, hang on, we've got you. We can fine you under our law because we've ratified this ILO convention. So we can actually seize your vessel, we can take your stock, we can charge you with breaking the law. But at the moment we say, it's none of our business, you know, you can have a 10-year-old child working on a fishing vessel, and nothing we can do about it.
But presumably many of these countries, as you say, have their own individual legislation that guarantees that a 10-year-old child is not working on a sea vessel.
And we have it in Australia. We have minimum standards for Australians working on these ships. The National Director of India was telling me that their minimum level of somebody working on a ship is 18 years of age. But if another ship came in with a child of 10 or 8, nothing they can do because they've not ratified this. So they can't say, sorry, you can't have that person work on that ship. It is illegal to have that person work on that ship. And until you employ people at the right age, we won't let your vessel go.
So explain this to me a little bit better. A ship comes in from Southeast Asia or something into an Australian port. It has a 10-year-old child working on board. Mm. The Australian port authorities are not allowed to do anything about it?
No. It's under a different country's rules and regulations.
But it's on Australian territory.
Yeah, but we've not ratified the convention, so we have no power to inspect it. Our maritime safety authorities cannot go on board the ship and look at the food conditions or look at the sleeping conditions on board the ship or the minimum age of the employees on the ship or how they're paid or how they're sustained. They have no authority to do anything other than say, is your ship seaworthy? Will it sink in our waters? If it won't sink in our waters, then off you go again.
So why aren't countries signing up for this?
I struggle to understand why.
They just don't want to be bothered. It's an extra police and security cost. Yeah.
They write the legislation for the ILO, and then it goes into a shelf, and it sits there. And the guys in the ILO struggle themselves to get these things out into the public. They come to us in the Pontifical Council meetings and said, we need to ask your help to get this to your governments so that your governments can understand from you that this is needed, because they're not listening to us. We're just the ILO. We might have a nice big logo and a nice big place that we all come to meet, but unless you do it in your country, it's not going to happen. We can scream and yell, but they're not going to listen to us. They'll only listen to you and your people because you're the voters. You're the ones that put the governments in power, and you're the ones that can take them out. And we can't do anything but ask them, please, can you ratify this? So we need to rattle cages in our governments. And every nation needs to look at these conventions and resolutions and say, adopt them. They're not so hard. You've already agreed to them. You've already had them on the table. You've read them all and you've said, yes, we agree to them. Adopt them. Make them work.
And what are some of the things that are contained in this convention?
The main things are minimum age.
It's called, actually, I see the brochure here, it's called Decent Working Conditions, Safety and Social Protection, Working in Fishing Convention.
Yeah, that is basically exactly what it says. It's the working conditions, what hours that people are made to work. They can't work people for 22 hours a day. They have a minimum food requirement and safe food, that they're not eating spoilt food, that young people are not brought into the industry below a certain age, that they have an education, that they are trained and educated in the work that they're undertaking, that they have the ability to be able to go ashore, to spend time, to make sure their families are fairly compensated for that person's employment. Then that person gets compensated well for their employment as well. These are just the minimum standards that we should have, that we expect in our jobs. In the first world, that we look for a job, we know when we go for an interview for a job that we're going to have a certain amount of hours that we're going to be working for, that we will have a morning tea and a lunch, that we will have a time that we will knock off and go home, that we'll have a weekend, or we're paid overtime, or
health insurance, retirement, all that sort of thing.
Superannuation, and whether you're compensated if you're injured at work.
Mm. But what about these? But isn't this quite onerous for many governments if they have to start policing or investigating to see whether even, you know, small family-run businesses, fishing vessels and so on, who might have one or two or three or four people working together? Isn't that maybe perhaps one of the reasons why governments haven't signed up to this? Because it's quite an onerous thing.
In some ways you could say yes, but if you're looking at a family business, then a family work at making it better for the family. They work at looking after each other. They care about each other. They're not going to work one of their family into the ground to say, you know, you keep slaving away so that, you know, I can have some time off or I can go on a holiday. So a family business is probably a good analogy for governments to look at, to say, would I look after my children this way? Would I treat my kids this way? Let's make sure that if you need a doctor, we make sure we get you to a doctor. You need good food, let's make sure I get you good food, not feed you poorly, not treat you poorly.
Do you ever get in this work that you do jaded? Do you ever feel, I'm fighting for the rights of these people and nothing's happening?
It becomes frustrating at times when you feel like often you're just a voice in the wilderness, you know, crying out, say, come on, do something. You get annoyed, and then all of a sudden you get a seafarer comes up to you and he'll say, thank you. And it'll just be, thank you for what? I didn't do anything. You did a lot for me. You spoke for me. You talked for us as fishers. You talked for us as seafarers. We heard you on a radio, or we read something about you in the newspaper, and you have nothing to gain by talking for us, and you talk for us. And just to get one person to say thank you just builds you up to say, I can fight harder, I can work harder, I can do more. Because you know you've made an effect on somebody. Maybe somebody you've never met, somebody you will never ever see, but you know that in your heart you've made something better for somebody else somewhere else. And that's the important thing that we should all have in our life, that whether you're a radio presenter here in the Vatican and you don't see a seafarer ever in your life, you know that through this media, you have touched a seafarer. You have touched somebody, you've made their life better. And in doing that, you've improved the world. You've made it better for seafarers. The listeners that listen to the broadcast will go and talk to somebody else, will talk to a family member and say, I heard this, I now know what this is about, and I can do something. So in every way you do something, you improve it. So that builds you up as a person. You say, we can make a difference, whether we're one or whether we're many, we can make a difference. And we do.
And a warm thanks there to Ted Richardson, the former regional director of the Apostleship of the Sea in Oceania.